This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I heard an interesting fact. Let me tell you where I got it. It's kind of somewhat related to our today's topic. It was from Steve Jackson, a scientist at Cambridge University who's been working on DNA and DNA repair mechanisms in cells. And it came from a podcast I listen to quite frequently that originates in England called the Naked Scientist podcast, which I would recommend for those of you who are interested in science. And he was quoted as saying that there are about 10 to the 14th cells in the human body. So if you take 10, put 14 zeros behind it, that's how many cells we have. And each day, each of those cells has about 100,000 hits on DNA from various things, mainly the most common just breakdown products of ozone, of oxygen in our own system, that causes damage to these DNA molecules. So when we hear about things that affect DNA, it's always a good idea to put this in perspective. But each cell, 100,000 times a day, is taking some damage to DNA. And I'm remarkably, animals, humans in particular in this case, have developed the proteins to really repair that damage. And they do a remarkably good job of making sure that cells continue to go about their daily business without any problems. But it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes there are mutations that lead to changes that are quite significant. And a lot of research is currently looking at that, as these changes as related to aging and how we might affect aging, but also, as we get to today's topic, how these changes in cells that can't get repaired completely may lead to cancer and significant mutations. But every day our body is dealing with somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to the 18th or 10 to the 19th lesions on DNA every day, repairing adequately and appropriately almost all of those. My guest today is Lily Shockney. She is a professor in the Department of Surgery and Department of Gynecology at Johns Hopkins University. She's recently been awarded the university's Distinguished Service Assistant Professor of Breast Cancer Award. She's been doing breast cancer education and care for a number of years, and she's a respected author on the subject of breast cancer. And in addition, she serves as an Ask the Expert on several breast cancer websites, including the Johns Hopkins breast cancer website. In addition, she's also been recognized for her efforts by a number of national organizations, especially the American Cancer Society and the Komen Foundation, and is also a recipient of the Outstanding Women of America Award. As I met Dr. Shockney earlier this afternoon on the radio, on the telephone, I was mentioning that she's been pretty busy. Thanks very much for taking the time for us today, Dr. Shockney, though.
Well, thanks for inviting me to join you. I appreciate it.
Our topic is breast cancer, and I would like to just start with a question that I think is important for all women, and I'd like to see how you'd answer this, is what should all women, not just women with breast cancer, but what should all women know about breast cancer? If I were to ask you that, what would you think is some of the most important bits of information?
I think there are several things that come to mind when I hear that. One is, I think it's important for women to understand that the majority of women diagnosed today with breast cancer are going to be long-term survivors. 85% statistically of all women that are diagnosed from stage 0 to stage 4 are going to be long-term survivors. Like myself, I'm a 16-year survivor. Additionally, 80% of women diagnosed are very good candidates for having a lumpectomy, which means that we can do breast conservation, save their breast, and not have to remove the breast. But for those that do need to have mastectomy surgery, and they fall into a very specific subgroup of women that have multiple tumors in the breast or have a very large tumor compared to breast volume, or perhaps have a specific type of breast cancer, such as inflammatory breast cancer, that warrants treatment with mastectomy, those individuals are candidates for having reconstruction done, and the types of reconstruction today, some of them are pretty phenomenal. So I think that that's good news all the way around, that we're able to save more lives and also save more breaths. Those that do need to have mastectomy, we can rebuild them a Memorex version of what we needed to take away.
Okay. Before we open the lines and I give our phone numbers, I think I'd like to move ahead to discussing what breast cancer is. And what I mean by that, what are the different types? You've already mentioned different types, inflammatory is a word that you'd used, and how that may be different. And you've used the term stage one and to stage four. So I think as women are diagnosed now and they're having a much better outcome, they're being faced with these different kinds of breast cancers. And so I'd like to, you know, kind of hone down on that for 5 or 10 mm-hmm. minutes and help us understand what this all means.
Sure. Of the 250,000 women that will be diagnosed during this calendar year, 80% of them will have the most common form of breast cancer, which is called invasive ductal carcinoma. This is breast cancer that grows in the ducts of the breast and has managed to break through the wall of the duct in order to get into the fatty tissue of the breast. The ducts actually transport milk from the lobules out to the nipple and then on to a baby if you're breastfeeding. 15% of women, however, will develop what's called invasive lobular carcinoma, that the breast cancer is actually grown in the lobules where the milk is made and has done the same thing in breaking through the wall of the lobule into that fatty tissue of the breast. This particular type of breast cancer can be a little trickier to diagnose because on a mammogram, it can be a little bit deceiving. It may look like a very small area when, in fact, once it's surgically removed or if we look at it at other types of technology such as an MRI, we may, in fact, find that it is larger. Invasive ductal has a tendency to grow starting, as I would say, from a circle and becoming a bigger circle and a bigger circle and a bigger circle, whereas invasive lobular looks more like a starburst with tentacles that are going off from that center. So you may have one piece that trails off into the breast, and all the rest of it may be contained. We've got to get our arms around that tumor and also have clear margins in all six directions around the tumor in order to effectively surgically treat it. And we do encourage women that when we do see that if they have fallen into the 15% and are dealing with invasive lobular carcinomas, we think it's a very good idea to not just rely on the mammogram measurements and ultrasound, but also to get a breast MRI that will help more clearly decipher the true size of what this tumor is in measurement, so that the appropriate surgery can be planned. There's a few rarer types, and one that I did mention a few moments ago that warrants some floor time here this evening is called inflammatory breast cancer. It is the type that is, frankly, the hardest to treat. There's also a problem with diagnosing it accurately. If you were to have a mammogram done and you, in fact, had inflammatory breast cancer, your mammogram more than likely would look fine. An ultrasound would probably look fine. Even an MRI may look fine. What the presentation is clinically is that the patient will say that she has a rash or a reddened area of skin on the breast. It is not unusual for this to be, unfortunately, misdiagnosed as mastitis. So a patient may be placed on antibiotics for several weeks only to find that it has not improved. And the recommendation is, if you think it's mastitis, then treat it with antibiotics for 5 days, and if it hasn't resolved in 5 days, it's not mastitis. And particularly if a woman is postmenopausal, the probability of her having mastitis when she is no longer menstruating and undergoing those types of hormonal changes and certainly not breastfeeding would be very low. So that's a flag to take a look at whether or not this is inflammatory breast cancer. The breast cancer cells actually grow in the skin and the dermal lymphatics of the skin. And it's diagnosed by doing a skin punch biopsy of that reddened area, just taking a piece of the surface of the skin, looking at it under the microscope, and in fact seeing lymphatic vessels, lymph node vessels running through it. Right from the start of a diagnosis of that being found in the skin of the breast, that is a stage 3 breast cancer. So it doesn't matter if it's a tiny speck or if the whole breast has turned red. That is a stage 3 diagnosis. The stages go from 0 to 4. Stage 0, which is another very important one to talk about, and it's one that I'm always relieved to see be what a woman has been diagnosed with, because it is non-invasive breast cancer called DCIS or ductal carcinoma in situ. And the term in situ has heavy meaning here in that it's not invasive disease. It's trapped in that duct, in that pipe that transports milk, and it has not figured out how to break through the wall of the duct. Therefore, it can't travel through the fatty tissue of the breast onto a lymph node. And if it can't get to a lymph node or to the blood supply, then it can't go anywhere else. So it is classified as stage 0. And it doesn't matter if you have a speck of DCIS or if your whole breast is full of DCIS, it still is 0. We don't begin actually measuring the diameter and having it influence the staging until the breast cancer does demonstrate that it has an invasive component. And then we do measure that specific invasive measurement, whether it be ductal or lobular, and that then helps us to determine is it stage 1, 2, 3, or 4. Stage 1 and 2 are considered early diagnoses with relatively smaller tumors that may or may not have gone to a few nodes. Stage 3 is referred to as locally advanced breast cancer, where multiple nodes are involved, and commonly tumors may be larger than 5 centimeters. Stage 4 means that the breast cancer has spread from the breast onto another organ site. Most commonly, the liver, lung, and bone are the sites where breast cancer likes to travel to. And about 15 to 20% of women may also have the breast cancer travel to the brain, something that may not be diagnosed until later on in her treatment or a failure of that treatment to have her body respond to it. There is a term that has been, I would have to say, misused, unfortunately, and it is LCIS. So it sounds like DCIS, one letter different. And it stands for lobular carcinoma in situ. And it frustrates me because it has the word carcinoma in it. So LCIS, though it sounds like it is cancer and sounds like it's non-invasive cancer, isn't cancer at all. It, in fact, is a marker for predicting increased risk of one day developing breast cancer. So if we see on a biopsy that a woman has LCIS, we don't need to remove all of the LCIS in her breast. What we do want to do, however, is to evaluate her to determine just how high of a risk is she for getting breast cancer. If we see she has LCIS, she also has a family history of breast cancer and may have a few other risk factors herself, then that's going to warrant close monitoring. In some cases, women may be having breast imaging done more often than annually. They're oftentimes having clinical breast exams done twice a year rather than once a year. And they may even choose to take some proactive steps in taking a drug called tamoxifen to reduce their risk of getting breast cancer. That particular drug, known as hormonal therapy, the opposite of hormone replacement therapy, has proven to be effective in prevention of this disease for women that are high risk and can reduce that risk by 47%. So half of women are going to find that they've got a very nice reduction by half of what their true risk is.
One of the comments that you made raised a question in my mind, and perhaps particularly women who are listening may also have had the same question. When you were talking about inflammatory breast cancer and you were talking about how the lesion as it begins on the surface of the breast may look like mastitis, I deal with a lot of young women who are breastfeeding, and mastitis is maybe overdiagnosed even in those women who also may have some blocked ducts. But it raises the question in my mind is that the diagnosis of mastitis in a young woman carry the same potential risk as this diagnosis of mastitis in a postmenopausal woman? Is this problem of inflammatory breast cancer age-related is what I'm getting at specifically?
Okay. It actually is not age-related. Okay. I've seen women in their 20s with it. I've seen women in their 80s with it. And the key is taking a look at day five of antibiotic therapy and seeing, does this breast look better?
Mm-hmm.
And if the rash has been persistent, if it's progressed on to some scaliness, and particularly if it's starting to involve the nipple and areola, then it's time to do a skin punch biopsy and rule out the presence of inflammatory breast cancer. I'd rather go through that step than to say, well, let's try antibiotics a while longer. Let's first make sure that we aren't dealing with something far more serious than mastitis.
Okay. Let me give everybody our phone number. If you're listening at this time, you're listening to Line 1. My guest is Dr. Lily Shockney, and we're talking about breast cancer with one of the really great educators on breast cancer in the country. So if you've got questions about any aspect of breast cancer, why don't you give us a call? Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Also, you can reach us by a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And by email at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. You had mentioned earlier that about 95% of breast cancers are either ductal, which is about 80%, and then lobular in 15%. And is there something – I'm jumping to the conclusion, and here's where I may need to be corrected, is that those 80% are the ones that are generally part of this high percentage now of women that are survivors, or is there something else different about these, both of these two cancers, which may lead to increased risk of difficulty treating?
They aren't easier or harder to treat. The prognostic factors associated with them actually predict how difficult or not so difficult they are to get into control, or in fact to hopefully be able to cure.
Okay.
A patient's age can influence this. If we have a postmenopausal older woman who has a lot of other comorbidities, that she's got congestive heart failure and she's a diabetic, has had a history of blood clots and such, her treatment options may be very limited, even though she has a very good quality breast cancer that has favorable prognostic factors. But her other medical conditions may preempt all of that in enabling us to effectively treat her. On the flip side, we may have a very healthy young woman who has either invasive ductal or invasive lobular, but it has unfavorable prognostic factors. And a couple examples of those prognostic factors are hormone receptors. Is it stimulated to grow by estrogen or progesterone? We like it when we see that it is. That usually implies that it's a fairly well-behaved breast cancer, and we can treat it with hormonal therapy. Anti-estrogen medication is one of the first lines of therapy to rid us of it, as well as to prevent its return. Another prognostic factor is HER2-new, a special oncogene measurement. It measures a very specific protein that the breast cancer cells produce, and if they are overproducing a particular one called HER2, that can tell us that it's a more mischievous breast cancer and maybe a bit more challenging to treat. There are specific drugs today available that are biological therapy for that particular type of prognostic factor. So that's made this far more treatable than it was even 10 years ago. And how quickly are these cells multiplying and subdividing? There's a factor called Ki-67 that tells us what is its reproduction rate. When we see a tumor that is growing very fast, might have a 60-70% Ki-67 score, though that's very worrisome. Ironically enough, chemotherapy works best with rapidly growing cells, because chemotherapy destroys rapidly growing cells rather indiscriminately, which is why the hair on our head will leave town, because that's a rapidly growing cell. But our eyebrows and eyelashes, if they're slower growing, may stay with us.
Okay. We have a couple of questions, callers coming in. Why don't we go ahead and take those? Joanne, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I have advanced fibrocystic disease in my breasts, and it makes it really, really hard to do self-exam. I wonder if that predisposes me at all to breast cancer, and if you had any words of wisdom for how you better manage your self-exams.
First, I want you to think of it not as a disease, but as a condition.
Okay.
The majority of women, particularly young women, have fibrocystic breasts. So you've got lumpy, bumpy breasts, and it can be more of a challenge in figuring out what is this lump and is this something to worry about or not. The very best person to know that is actually going to be you by being very diligent in doing a breast self-exam every month. I want you to know the architecture and geography of your breasts so that next month, if you feel something that's different, say, gee, this lump feels larger than before, or I have a new bump here, that's precisely what we're looking for when we're telling women to check their own breasts, is we want you to identify a change, if a change in fact has happened. Another thing to think about is if you're now getting mammograms each year, to seek out a facility that offers digital mammography.
Yes.
This provides a little clearer picture, 28% clearer, as a matter of fact, than the traditional film mammogram, also known as analog mammography. The mammogram is done the exact same ways that you get swished up and down and side to side, but it's captured electronically and enables us in reading that mammogram using the computer, I can lighten and darken the contrast in the background so that lumpiness and bumpiness that may have shown as being very white on a traditional film X-ray, now I can actually see within it. So that's a great benefit for women that do have fibrocystic breasts. Does it predispose you for getting breast cancer? It actually does not. The only challenge is it can result in there being a delay in diagnosing you if your doctor isn't very familiar with your breasts and you aren't very familiar with your breasts. That 'cause we can't rely on mammography to find breast cancer 100% of the time. It finds it 80% of the time, but 20% is going to be through other technology or through an examination.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty well on top of it, but I know that there are a lot of women that go, oh, I just don't even do self-exam anymore because I just can't tell, you know, I go run to my doctor every time I have a change and it's nothing. And so I just, I know I try and be diligent and talk to other women about doing the same, but I think I appreciate your message. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Schachting, let's follow up on Joanne's last comment there about I'm guessing that you would say the most important preventative aspect of breast cancer is the self-exam, and perhaps you should comment on that. And
yes, it's been an issue of controversy that some European studies have said, oh, breast self-exam is not of benefit, it isn't saving more lives. I take a very different approach to that statement, and we do here at Johns Hopkins as well, in encouraging and promoting women to do breast self-exams. 40% of women diagnosed with breast cancer found their own lump. I don't know why I would want to tell those 40% stop looking, because that would have meant that they would have delayed X number of months until it was time for them to have their annual clinical breast exam. And, of course, the sooner we can identify this, the better, because we're hoping that she will need lesser treatment than if we delay it by many months and then identify it by having done a clinical breast exam or looking at a mammogram. I myself, I'm 16 years out. I was 38 when I was diagnosed, and then again at 40. Both times I found my own lump, and I wasn't even ready to be having mammograms annually yet. So I think it's very important for women to know their bodies. They need to be their own advocate regarding this. Now, Joanne did make a comment, and I think it was an important one, is that she has friends who are frustrated and saying, I don't know what I'm supposed to be checking for, and then I run off to the doctor, and I feel like I'm maybe a cry wolf situation. I would far prefer for those individuals to run off to the doctor and say, assure me this isn't anything. Over time, they're going to find that they're running off to the doctor or nurse practitioner less and less as they know their anatomy. They know that geography of their breasts better and better. I think it's similar to a man having chest pain. You know, we don't hesitate to say to them, I don't care if the doctor says you have indigestion. I want you to go to the doctor. You might be having a heart attack. That one time that a woman finds something and then doesn't go to follow it up may very well be the time that she, in fact, does have cancer in her breast, and it would be an awful thing for her to be kicking herself later saying, oh, my gosh, I should have gone. I'd rather her go and the doctor say you're fine.
Any advice while we're on the topic of self-exams on the frequency and exactly how that maybe should be done?
Yes, a breast self-exam for women that are still menstruating should be done a few days after their menstrual period has begun, which in essence is right at the tail end of their menstrual cycle. That's when their breasts are going to be the least tender. They're going to be the least influenced by hormonal changes, and the geography of that breast is going to be easier to evaluate. I am a believer in using several different positions to really do a thorough exam. The first is going to be in the shower when your hands are wet and soapy, and feeling if you find anything while taking a shower, and you've got your arm up over your head so that you're also checking in your armpit area as well. Second is to lay down on a flat surface, folding up a blanket or putting a pillow underneath of your shoulder blade, which helps to spread out the breast a bit more, making it flatter. And examining the breast, keeping in mind that we just don't want to check the mound. Oftentimes women say, well, my breast is that breast mound. Your breast tissue actually goes up to just below your clavicle. And it goes down to 2 inches below that mound, which is usually where the bandeau of your bra is, and goes over to your armpit. So it covers a larger area than what we oftentimes think about because we focus on a bra holding all of the breast, and in fact it doesn't physically hold all of it. It holds most of it. The third is standing in front of a mirror and putting your hands on your hips and flexing your arms forward and back to see, do you see any change in the breast? Do you see any dimpling? If you put your hands up over your head, does the contour of one breast look different than the other? One of the signals that we look for is a pulling in of tissue, particularly a dimpling, that can signify there's something inside that's tugging inward. And cancer cells, in fact, when they're formed into a tumor, do have a tendency to pull tissue inward towards the center of the body.
I have another caller, Emily. You're on line one. Thanks for holding on. What can we do for you?
Thank you for taking my call. I am a breast cancer graduate. I had the classic invasive ductal carcinoma stage one. I elected to have a mastectomy, and this is what I wanted to talk about. Due to the lumpectomy statistics, the survival rates, my understanding, assume that the cancer patient has the wherewithal to subsequently have a mastectomy should the cancer come back. Those of us without ongoing health insurance or who don't want to have multiple surgeries often make different decisions and elect to have, as I did, elect to have a mastectomy when it's not, you know, stage three or stage four. And I'd like to hear comment back about that. And the second thing, you imply that it's only with a mastectomy that you're allowed to have reconstructive surgery. And unless something's changed in the last couple of years since I had my surgery, that was entirely an option for lumpectomy if the lumpectomy results in, you know, a less than satisfactory presentation. I believe health insurance companies are required to let the patient also have reconstructive surgery. So I would appreciate a comment about the lumpectomy statistics because fall into the category where I didn't want to come back and have another surgery. And my statistical survival rate was better electing to have a mastectomy to start with.
Okay, so let's talk about each of those. First of all, congratulations on being a graduate, a fellow graduate.
You.
I'm always thrilled to be able to talk to someone else who's been in my bra, and you clearly have been. When we look at lumpectomy with radiation and compare it to mastectomy from a survival perspective, the statistics match. So doing more surgery doesn't result in a higher survival rate, even if the breast cancer returns in the breast that we did the lumpectomy in. Now, is the recurrence rate different between lumpectomy with radiation and mastectomy? And there the answer is yes. 10 to 15% of women who have a lumpectomy followed by radiation will develop a local recurrence in that conserved breast, and at that time then need to do mastectomy as part of her definitive treatment for that recurrence. Her survival, though, curiously enough, and this has been studied with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of women in order to finally prove this, survival, even when she develops that recurrence, still was equal as if she had had a mastectomy from the start.
That's my point, but
you're assuming that 100% of women are going to have local recurrence and only 10 to 15% will. So 80 to 85% of women will have a lumpectomy and radiation and never see breast cancer again. Women that are very pro saving their nipple and areola are usually the ones that are going to lean more towards doing lumpectomy. It is the patient's right to choose which she wants to do as long as she is an informed patient as to what her options are, what the risks and benefits are, so that she can make that decision as an informed consumer. Now, when we look at reconstruction, the rule of thumb for a breast surgeon is that if the surgeon needed to take away so much breast tissue that the breast looks deformed and warrants reconstruction, they have not done justice to that patient. The patient should have had a skin-sparing mastectomy with reconstruction done instead. Reconstruction and lumpectomy don't go very well together, and it's because of the radiation. The skin goes through changes after radiation, and implants are what oftentimes have been used as the form of reconstruction with lumpectomy. And though it initially may look okay, over time, more than 50% aren't going to look okay because implants and radiation just don't get along.
The surgeons I talked to up here in Alaska recommended that you, if you're going to have a lumpectomy, or, and in my case, if you had a mastectomy, that you have that surgery first, and you know any chemotherapy or radiation that was appropriate, go through all of that, and then have your reconstructive surgery for that very reason. And so I did not have reconstructive surgery at the time I had a mastectomy. I was also told I might feel like I'd been run over by a truck. But even with lumpectomies, you know, they say don't do that now. Wait until you're finished with everything, and that's what, you know, the advice was of the experts up here, which made sense.
Even when you're finished with everything, let's say it's 4 years out from having completed your radiation, and we take an implant and enhance your breast on the lumpectomy side. A year from that time, 50% of women are going to say, "What the heck is wrong with this thing? Something's happened." And it's because that it doesn't matter if we did the radiation before, after, or a decade later, the body says, "I remember I've been radiated, and I remember I don't like implants." It's just an anatomic phenomenon. Now, from the you also mentioned about the federal law. There is a federal law that has been passed that does require that breast reconstruction be covered. It is most specifically for mastectomy surgery, though I haven't seen any insurance companies challenge it for ensuring symmetry. So the law says insurance companies are required to cover breast reconstruction for someone who has had a diagnosis of breast cancer at some point in time in her lifetime, and it is to ensure that she has symmetry of her two breasts symmetrically matching. And it doesn't say how that is, whether it be lumpectomy on the other side, or are we enhancing, or are we doing augmentation, or are we doing a reduction. There is a funny story associated with how the bill got passed, which I'll share with you. This bill was presented in 1995, 96, and 97 on Capitol Hill, and those 3 years the hammer got slammed down, and they said, no, we don't think this is something insurance should cover. It's cosmetic surgery. It's not part of breast cancer treatment, and the answer is no. I was asked to go over to testify in January of 98, so I read through previous testimonies. I thought, I don't want to say the same thing that's been said before, is obviously it didn't work. And there were women that had gone over and said that they had had mastectomy surgery, that they couldn't afford to do reconstruction, and how frustrated they are with that. Other women said, I've had reconstruction, and it cost me a fortune. I've got a second mortgage on my house. So all the right things were said to try to move the individuals listening to this, in order to have them say, yes, we think insurance should cover it, and yes, we think it's part of her psychological well-being and healing, but they slammed that hammer down. So I contacted 16 insurance companies and asked if they covered testicular implants for testicular cancer, and they all did. So that's what I used as my testimony, saying, I think we're here to tell you it's our turn, and we would like to have this covered by insurance. So we got the bill passed.
Well, if I can interject one more thing, you mentioned that the need to have reconstructive surgery may be some sort of a reflection on the surgeon if he didn't or she didn't do a particularly good job, but sometimes one doesn't know how the lumpectomy is going to turn out until one gets in there to see how really where it is and how far it's spread or if it's gone up into your lymph nodes and so forth. So it's kind of an unknown as to whether you might need reconstructive surgery until after, or want it until after the fact with a lumpectomy. Is that correct?
Well, if you have an experienced breast surgeon who's done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases, from his or her experience, that physician actually should know, looking at appropriate breast imaging studies such as breast MR, digital mammography, to know how much tissue do I need to take out, and then guesstimating what is that breast going to look like when I get done. The upper outer quadrant of the breast is the most forgiving. It has a tendency to fill back in with fatty tissue, and we don't see volume loss. If you had even a small breast cancer, though, in the lower inner quadrant of the breast, it's not forgiving. And even a small amount of tissue, you're going to notice a little bit of a defect. So if you have a relatively larger tumor in that area, it's going to be a given right from the start. This is not going to look very good when I get this out and a margin of tissue that's healthy tissue around it. Cosmetically, patients are probably going to be unhappy. You then add radiation to that, and a portion of women will have, as a result of the radiation, the breast tissue that remains shrink some, so that, in fact, could even make her more unhappy. If surgery is done and she looks at it, even though the surgeon may say, gee, I think this looks pretty good, you know, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, the patient may say, I don't think this looks good at all, rather than proceeding on with radiation, stop. And say, rather than exposing you to an additional adjuvant therapy, if you're going to do mastectomy, let's do that now and not have you go through radiation, which in fact you would not need if we're going to be doing mastectomy as your surgical option.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Okay. I appreciate your
Thanks for your call, Emily.
And comments.
Yep,
sure.
Appreciate it. All right, let me remind our listeners, this is Line 1. Our topic today is breast cancer. Just about any question you might have about that, please give us a call, and you can get an answer from Lily Shockney, one of the educators at the Johns Hopkins Breast Center, and certainly one of the better educated and experienced breast cancer educators in the country. Our number, 550-8433, 550-8433. You can also email us at lineone, spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Before I go to my next question, I also want to remind our listeners that you can go to kska.org, line one, and at any time listen to this podcast. You can refer other listeners to the podcast, and you can even subscribe to have it regularly sent to you. In addition, Ms. Shockney is going to be appearing by teleconference at a breast cancer conference this Friday, October 17th, at the Providence Cancer Center. It appears from the topics being discussed, this is primarily for providers. I'm sure those of you in the public who might be interested might want to find out more about it by calling the Providence Cancer Center as well to see if it might be appropriate for you, or you might share that information with your providers. I understand there's over 100 physicians already signed up as well. Let's tackle another topic here, a little bit different, but one of which there is seems to be still a lot of confusion, and that's the area of hormonal replacement therapy, as related as maybe different from cells in the in a cancer that are responsive to hormones, and what's the risk of this currently? What do we know about it? How did it get to be so such a confusing issue in the first place?
It certainly is and has been now for a couple of years a hot topic of is hormone replacement therapy safe or unsafe, and if it's safe, who is it safe for? What we do know is that if a woman is destined to get breast cancer in her lifetime, then taking hormone replacement therapy will more than likely speed up that diagnosis by about a decade. And the reason why is that it has the ability to fuel it like fertilizer. The majority of postmenopausal women diagnosed with breast cancer develop breast cancer that has a good prognostic factor, that hormone receptor positivity of estrogen and or progesterone. Unfortunately, HRT is estrogen and some are estrogen with progesterone, so that if you're taking something medication that we know has fat, has properties in it that can feed breast cancer cells, then of course that breast cancer is going to grow and going to get bigger. There is controversy over, is there any group of women that it is safe to give HRT to? Hormone replacement therapy was extremely popular with many, many, many women taking it and not worrying about the consequences of it. If you went to your doctor and said, I'm having hot flashes and night sweats, the most common thing that you would walk away from that doctor's appointment with is a prescription for some type of hormone replacement therapy. Now they've stepped back and saying, maybe this isn't good for everybody. Maybe we better revisit the use of this drug, and now there's great caution that it is expected that a doctor will know what questions to ask and really more closely evaluate his patient in determining is she at increased risk of getting breast cancer, and am I potentially adding to that risk by prescribing this medication for her. So if a woman has a personal history of breast cancer, has been diagnosed herself before, she is not ever to be on HRT. If she has a first-degree relative who's been diagnosed, then there should be tremendous caution and careful consideration in recommending HRT. The most common reasons for giving HRT is control of menopausal symptoms, and physicians and nurses are now being guided to look at alternatives other than a prescription for hormone replacement therapy as a way to help that patient get those menopausal symptoms into control. Whether that be sleeping on a chillo pillow or wearing layers of cotton that she can then shed when she has a hot flash, avoiding drinking hot beverages, avoiding spicy foods, all those things that she probably can tell you gee, I know what triggers mine. These are the factors that I know if I do these things, I'm going to end up with a hot flash. So looking at some alternative methods rather than a chemical method of controlling her menopausal symptoms.
Nope. We have another caller. Let's take Lene. You're on line one.
Hi there. I'm just calling in. It was 2 years ago. I was 35 years old, and I was diagnosed with DCIS, and I had a double mastectomy with no radiation, chemo, and no hormone tamoxifen or whatever. And I'm just really confused on whether or not I even had breast cancer since it's the zero stage. Did I or didn't I?
So if this was DCIS, ductocarcinoma in situ, you in fact did have breast cancer. It was non-invasive breast cancer, stage zero, as you mentioned. So this was identified the earliest that we could possibly identify breast cancer. I'm assuming this was found with a mammogram?
Actually, I felt it myself. I was, it was confirmed that way, but I felt a small lump.
And so you've taken a very aggressive step in helping to ensure that you will never visit this disease again in doing bilateral mastectomies. And did you have any family history?
I had an aunt who was diagnosed with lobular cancer when she was almost 50 years old.
Okay.
But I did genetic testing, and I was negative on that.
Okay. You bring up a good point that oftentimes women will say, well, my mother had lobular, so am I at higher risk for lobular? The type of breast cancer is not something that's passed down through heredity. One person can have invasive, another family member can have lobular, another one can have inflammatory. Some can have a mixture of invasive ductal and invasive lobular called mammary. So we don't genetically pass down the type of breast cancer that we had. It simply is the type of cancer, breast being the one that we're talking about this evening. Well, it's good to hear that you're doing well, and you no longer will need to do mammograms.
yeah.
So that's probably giving you some peace of mind, too.
It is, but being so young, I'm constantly wondering, is this going to creep up in some other fashion as I age in life? But it's just something I think I have to deal with.
Yeah, well, the possibility of it of you seeing breast cancer again is well less than 1%, and that's a good number to be able to live with.
Definitely.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Mm-hmm. Well, we seem to be oscillating around another important issue, and that's what do we know about known risk factors? If we're going to talk about prevention that's another issue where we seem to be getting some confusing bits of information at times. What does the Johns Hopkins establishment tell us about risk factors that we need to be aware of?
There are some known risk factors, but let me begin by saying 70% of women diagnosed with breast cancer have no known risk factors, which means there's some risk factors we haven't identified yet, and they must be pretty significant ones, with the majority of women not having any of them. But the ones that we do know, being female places us at higher risk of developing breast cancer than, say, a man. Men make up 1% of the individuals diagnosed with breast cancer each year. Our age going up, which is an interesting thing. I'd done some programs at college campuses, and the most common answer that college students answered incorrectly was the risk of breast cancer increases with age, and most of them wrote false, when in fact, as we get older, our risk does go up to the point that when we reach the age of 80, our risk is 1 in 8. So, and it has been said, though there's no way to prove it at this point in time, that if all women live to be 106, more than 90% would have breast cancer by that time. I'm not sure that we will all ever live to be 106 in order to prove that theory out. Personal family history of breast or ovarian cancer is also a known risk factor. A breast biopsy in the past that has shown atypical cells or LCIS, lobular carcinoma in situ that I talked about earlier, carrying a breast cancer gene. And that's usually found because there are several family relatives diagnosed young, and then another one is yet diagnosed. And then at that point, they say, let's do a blood test and take a look to see if this was actually caused by a breast cancer gene, BRCA1 or BRCA2. For women that do carry BRCA1 or BRCA2, they have between a 65 and 80% risk of developing breast cancer, and they commonly will do prophylactic mastectomies and oophorectomies to reduce that risk. Having your first biological child after the age of 30, so having children young, though that may make you go crazy at the same time, it does help to reduce your risk of getting this disease. Having menstruation start under the age of 12, today, you know, in 2008, it is not unusual for a young girl to begin menstruating at 9, 10, or 11 years old. But we have identified that now if it's under the age of 12, that is an increased risk factor. Going through menopause and having menopause completed after age 55 is also a risk factor. We talked about HRT and its influence. We also need to take a look at race. More Caucasian women are diagnosed, but there's a higher mortality among African-American women. If a woman has had what's referred to as mantle radiation as a child, commonly given to treat Hodgkin's lymphoma, 28% of women who have had mantle radiation to their torso when they were young do in fact go on to develop breast cancer or thyroid cancer because of that radiation exposure when they were young. Alcohol consumption also can bump up risk. Having more than one alcoholic beverage a day, and it doesn't matter if it's wine, beer, or a mixed drink. Smoking also increases risk, as does also obesity. And that's fairly new to have identified that obesity can be and is tied to an increased risk for developing breast cancer. One of the theories behind that is that we store estrogen in our body fat. So if we're carrying around more estrogen, then that's more estrogen to potentially be feeding a cell that wants to turn into a breast cancer cell.
How about myths? I always like to think about what are the myths that you hear that maybe we haven't already discussed that are important to put the proper perspective in?
There's a couple interesting myths that still seem to be alive and well on the internet. One is that antiperspirants and deodorants are the cause of breast cancer. I am convinced that whoever started this this idea wants the world to smell differently, perhaps. We don't see any reason to believe that is a contributing cause of breast cancer. And probably most importantly, breast cancer doesn't go from the lymph nodes backward into the breast. It goes from the breast outward into the lymph nodes. Another myth is, I can't get breast cancer because I don't have any family history of it. Therefore, I'm not in that population of women that potentially could get this disease. Only 12% of women diagnosed with breast cancer have a family history. So 88% don't have any history whatsoever. Another myth is that underwire bras are a cause of breast cancer. They are not. That has been studied, and they are not a contributing factor either to this disease. And there also has been some concerns about abortion, and does that increase risk of breast cancer? And that has been, I think, very well studied because of the concerns that women have raised in regard to that, and it has validated that also has no contributing factor to developing breast cancer later.
Are there some concerns that scientists involved with you on a regular basis at the Breast Cancer Center there at Johns Hopkins, are there some environmental concerns that are maybe unproven at this time but are pretty suspect and are deserving of maybe discussion about and for listeners to pay more attention to, or if they're really concerned to avoid?
There's two things that are of not just of interest but that are on the plate for investing more research dollars in so we can provide consumers with better answers. But one has already been proven, and that is secondary smoke. So you just don't have to be the one holding the cigarette in your hand. If you're smelling the cigarette from someone else, that secondary smoke is presenting itself to be a risk factor for you, as if you were the one holding that cigarette. The American Cancer Society has said that if we could rid the world of tobacco, there would be an 80% reduction in the incidences of all types of cancer, which I go, wow, that's absolutely incredible, truly incredible. Another is looking at pesticides, insecticides. There have been some studies, though they've been 5,000 to 10,000 patients in these studies, so they haven't been the huge aggregate 100,000 and 200,000 women being studied. But these studies have shown a correlation between exposures to some insecticides and the development of breast cancer, as well as the development of prostate cancer. And when I think about that, it actually makes some sense. If children are outside at the time that insecticides are sprayed, so we're looking at agricultural country and farmland where airplanes are going to spray for bugs, kids are outside playing in the yard, that blows over to them, they breathe that in. Our breasts function similarly to a sweat gland, and so we store what we breathe in there. The prostate does the same thing to them. And we know that breastfeeding for 3 consecutive years reduces our risk of getting breast cancer. And I think what's probably happening is that whatever carcinogens may be in there, the epithelial cells are now being sloughed out with that breast milk, taking away that increased risk. But a study done on Long Island showed that women who, in fact, did have a diagnosis of breast cancer also tested positive for having insecticides in the ducts of their breasts, and those insecticides had not been used for more than 30 years in that area, and it was DDT.
Okay. We're getting down to a little over a minute left. I want to mention the Breast Cancer Chronicles. You might comment on that, and I suspect that's a place where people who are listening to this at a later time, this broadcast, may have questions, and they can ask you directly through the Breast Cancer Chronicles. Am I correct about that?
Yes, and they also can go to the Johns Hopkins Breast Center website, hopkinsbreastcenter.org. I'm right on the homepage. They can click on my email address right on there. The Chronicles are posted on Yahoo. I do post 2 to 3 abstracts on there a week, and I do get asked some curious questions. One that was probably the most interesting one that I've responded to was an individual who asked, she said that her uncle had become her aunt having a sex change done, and was he, who's now a she, at higher risk of developing breast cancer? And the answer was yes, because of taking HRT and other measures to increase female hormone content in their bodies.
Always something unusual out there. Thanks.
Yes. I guess that person said, I don't think I can get this question answered anywhere else. I'm going to go to Lily. Yeah.
Well, I want to take my time to express my great appreciation for Lily Shockney joining us today on Line 1. Thanks very much, Ms. Shockney.
Thanks for having me.
Next week, Line 1 will be back again, and we'll be discussing anxiety with Dr. Margaret Weinberg. She's an expert on the area as well, and we'll be talking about specifically treatments of various manifestations of anxiety. So tune into your health and learn more. Monday, October 20th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1 for KSKA and for Line 1. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.